Welcome to the 40K Lorecast.
Welcome to the 40K Lorecast with me, John Barsotti, and Brad Chester.
This guy.
On today's cast, we're jumping into what might be the greatest fall of all the traitor legions, the Emperor's Children. 40K Lorecast is a weekly podcast focusing on the lore of the Warhammer 40K universe, releasing every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. If you check our show notes, you'll see links to our website where you can find our merchandise, upcoming major, other projects, and more. You can also find a link to our Patreon where you can come in and support the show. More coming on that in the next couple of months, guys. Just heads up, we're going to be expanding out our Patreon.
So much more
opportunities. Yep. And of course, a link to our Discord. We always push the Discord, and there's a reason for it. If you enjoy the cast, we really do welcome you to join our Discord and give it a shot. It's a completely free server. It has everything from 40K lore, literature, gameplay, but more importantly, just communication and conversations around things like video games, memes, fan theories, anything. And it's really become this very healthy and fun place that has literal thousands of members, not just members, but active people speaking and interacting around the 40K universe and more. So please come in and give it a shot. As always, huge shout out to the mods, a very large team of mods we have helping keep it exactly those things. So the Third Legion, like all Space Marine Legions, the Third Legion's origins come from the Unification Wars. While it's weird. They don't take part in the Unification Wars because they're actually, all right, let me say it a better way for everybody. In the older lore, they didn't take part in the Unification Wars, but then randomly there's a note somewhere about them pacifying Antarctica. I don't know. But the way the lore was always written, the way I read it, was that at the end of the Unification Wars, that's when the Emperor's said differently. Some of the legions actually came into being during the Unification Wars and fought a little bit in them. I think the Blood Angels are one of them. I want to say the Space Wolves were as well, but it wasn't like the full legion. It was small portions of them.
Dark Angels, they pulled people from too. Most of them did not, though. Almost all of them, to be fair, did not take part in that. They were just created and sent out.
Yeah, they were formed in the after effect. And one of the key pieces about this when they were formed is the people that they pulled from were aligned with the genetic makeup or kind of the genetic destiny that they were going to have. So, for example, the Night Lords were all pulled from the criminal elements. The Iron Hands came from these like really super high-tech wastelands. The Imperial Fists came from these like builder sections where it was all the architects. And the World Eaters came from all the people that failed the psychological assessment from the other legions.
You know, weird that those two guys ended up falling to chaos, huh?
Crazy. Yeah, and by the way, the World Eaters one, I'm only half kidding about. Anyone who's taken a job, they give like a psychological assessment, or they should at most jobs, by the way. If they don't, good for you. But the World Eaters effectively were like, yeah, these guys are all completely insane.
Eaters. Just extra violent.
And no, they were also completely insane. There's a level to extra violent. Like, what's the difference? Like between a World Eater recruit and a Night Lord recruit?
One and a half dozen of another.
Well, the Night Lord one was like, I stab someone, but then I run away. And the World Eater one's like, I stab someone, and they stand over the body to see if anyone else wants some stabbing.
You want some stabbing? I'm giving it away free here. Yeah. Two for one.
The knife's still sharp. What you got? That's basically the World Eaters.
You know who's not that, though? The Emperor's Children. Yeah. Let's talk about Pinky. When you say Emperor's Children, you should have to say it with pinkies out.
Yeah, so Emperor's Children, at this point, the Third Legion, came from the nobility of their conquered enemies, specifically those that weren't slaughtered by the Thunder Warriors. It's actually an interesting history because the Emperor effectively informed all these noble households that he was imposing an imperial tithe on them and that they were all to supply their children to fill the ranks of his new armed forces. But I want to point out this is a little bit different than the Custodes, because the Custodes have a similar history. The Custodes come from the nobility of Terra. The custodes come from those who were loyal to
Exactly.
Blizzard.
I was about to say, you're going to get custode fans, you know, jumping through the window, but doing hi-ya on us.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a big difference. These are the remnants of the noble houses that the emperor beat the snot out of.
Yeah, these were conquered.
Yeah, custodes were all the loyal. Well, that's a big deal, though, because the custodes are considered the most loyal since the beginning.
And that's because all the custodes can draw their lineage back to the first people who ever aligned with the emperor. The third legion draw their lineage back to the people that the emperor, for whatever reason, didn't murder. That's basically where they come from, of nobility. The fun part about this, though, is that in the imperial records, all of these families were super happy to hand over all their children to be the emperor's warriors because they wanted to atone for daring to stand in opposition to him. And I view this more as a like less of a desire to atone and more of a desire not to be visited by friends of Malkador in the night.
Yeah. You're like, what did you want? I gave you twice as much as you asked for. Mainly because
please don't.
We lost so badly. I don't want to see the bad guys.
Yeah. Like, well, it's we lost so badly. Then you murdered all the people that murdered us. And so, and then the people who murdered all the people who murdered all of us are just floating around somewhere. I don't want to meet that person. Anyway, because their noble background, the emperor's children took on an interesting role within the legions, and it's that of leader. Not as like a literal leader in the sense of like, oh, we're in charge, but in a spirit leader. And it's they handled themselves as if they were the nobility within the emperor's legions. And in a couple of kind of key ways. So we don't mean this in the sense of they were the leader of the legions, because within the legions, they would have just been told, yeah, go to hell. It was what the emperor utilized them for. You know, as we said, the Dark Angels were used for kind of like horrifying engagements no one can ever know about. You know, the World Eaters, the Space Wolves were used for sending a message. You know, those everyone had a purpose. The Third Legion were actually interesting. One of their biggest piece was emissaries because they carried themselves with such nobility.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, they were the poster boys also. So they got the engagements that you could put on movie reels when you were doing propaganda pieces. The Emperor's children showed up with perfect precision. Everything looked perfect when they came in. And that was one of their driving things, is always to be exactly perfect looking too. You know, everything.
Yeah. Their armor was crisp and clean, all that stuff. But they would even use them just to send, like when the Emperor would go to bring a world into Imperial compliance, for example. When he brings them into Imperial compliance, not all the times, actually most of the times, it wouldn't open with hostilities. He would send down an emissary. It was usually the Third Legion he would send in. He also would do it in a weird way, by the way. That's also written in the codexes. When he has to like send an emissary to other members like of the Imperium, he would send the Emperor's children like carrying a letter, which made me think, maybe laugh. I was thinking about the Emperor being so old that he's actually sending things certified mail instead of like just sending a text message or an email. He's actually sending a certified letter. Just one of those weird things he does. You're like, what?
That is funny though, because you could actually send the most encrypted thing.
Yeah, and instead he hands a letter to a dude with like a wax. I mean, it probably was. He was holding a tablet that was impossibly encrypted, and like five Space Marines would deliver it to like the other Lord of Terra, and that guy probably would get it and go, "Hey, thanks. Open, read it, and then email his buddies what the Emperor told him." Because, you know, that's how you function. But it's the Emperor, and no one can talk crap on the fact that he's like, you know, 30,000 or 50,000 years old, however thousand years old at this point. And they're just like, look, he's old. Don't send him a PDF. Another area that the Emperor's children took on really well was leading the Imperial army. And this was kind of cool because Space Marines are at their core super soldiers. That's really that, you know, when GW wrote this outright many, many years ago, the goal was to write a super soldier. And truthfully, like the level of super is pretty insane, but that's, you know, we've covered that in different casts. They served alongside regular dudes, right? And a lot of the legions in the lore hated this because they viewed the Imperial army. Yeah, they were just slow, dumb. I mean, again, these weren't dumb people, but compared to a space marine, they're a moron, you know, and they were most importantly really, really squishy. And so this meant that for the most part, the space marine legions saw the Imperial Army as just getting in their way more than anything else, because they had to run around them or wait for them and do all these things. And we covered this a bit. We talked about how Leman Russ lost his mind over having to carry remembrancers with him into battle, and how they all just kept mysteriously getting shot by the enemy. Yeah, like 1,000 times shot by the enemy, because he was making random dudes without power armor run across the battlefield. And the enemy went, well, that dude's not killing me. Thump.
in a huge contrast to this, the Emperor's children, because of the fact that they were from nobility, took on this task. They were super, actually very, not a little prideful. Wow. All of the prideful.
Wildly prideful.
Well, they took him on to be fair. I feel like they looked at him as servants.
Yeah, I think the comparison, we did the Knights cast, so it makes it really easy. It's very similar to the way the Knight pilots viewed the people of their planets, where they viewed them as weak and squishy. And so they actually took pride in leading them to success in combat, whereas the other Space Marine legions would just say, cool, cannon fodder. And they would send them out to kind of do whatever and make their lives easier. The Emperor's children actually took pride in helping the Imperial Army succeed and succeed well. They wouldn't share the glory by any means, but that was kind of their way of getting even more glory. It was like, look, I took these like pseudo morons and I was able to have them be successful. How amazing a leader am I?
I think it's also they wanted to go, hey, did you guys all see how awesome I was about 10 minutes ago?
Now, the irony of this to me is that as an Imperial soldier, your best possible situation was to be garrisoned with the Emperor's children, versus obviously space wolves or world eaters. But this takes a rough turn later in this episode. It becomes worst one to be stationed with.
you had hundreds of years of good before you had, oh my God, 10,000 years of awful.
So the other guys are shoving nails in your skulls. Yeah, that's actually better. I'm going to go ahead and admit it.
Hold on, John. You had the opportunity to say nails in your head, luxury. We had was
luxury. What I wouldn't give to have nails shoved into my head.
Exactly.
So let's talk on to why they became eventually known as the Emperor's Children. This is a title given to them later actually by Fulgrim, but they became the Emperor's favorite early on in the campaigns. And so during the onset of the Crusade, the Third Legion, like everyone else, were sent all over the place, sometimes diplomatic, sometimes for force. On one world was a world called Proxima, and this is where they actually gained the ultimate notoriety of any Space Marine Legion. And we'll get to it in a second, but these guys become more important to the Emperor than even the Ultramarines for a period of time. One of the key worlds in this was Proxima. And so Proxima was brought into Imperial compliance by force. The Emperor was actually on the planet with the Third Legion and a force of his custodes when a full-blown rebellion breaks out. And during this rebellion, a rebel or multiple rebels, who cares, threw a vortex grenade. And the black hole it created hits the Emperor, and all we know is it drops him. There's no details in damage or any of that stuff. It's entirely possible that the Emperor was actually killed on Proxima, but because he's a perpetual, he just, you know, pops back up. He will pop back up later. Just
Highlander
like,
style.
Yeah, it's pure Highlander, which is why I kind of wish the Emperor was dressed in that weird, was it red armor that Sean Connery was wearing? That was a very strange Sean Connery. The accents were all wrong. Everything about that was odd.
He was a Spanish Egyptian, man.
Yeah, he was a Spanish Egyptian with a Scottish accent.
Which he has in every single thing he does.
Yeah.
Russian submarine commander. Scottish accent.
Scottish accent. Well, no, Russian Scottish accent. So he had a Russian Spanish Egyptian accent. So for those of you who haven't seen Highlander,
Watch it. It won the Oscar for greatest movie of all time.
Ever made. It's so good. It isn't a great movie. Like, just letting you know, if you're watching it with like a spouse, they may walk away. It's okay, but it's still decently okay. Anyway, so whatever the reason, the Emperor is now out of commission, and the hordes of rebels just come tearing down the 3rd Legion and the Custodes. The 3rd Legion hold their ground shoulder to shoulder with the Custodes, and they do. Every single one of them perishes. Just as the rebels, though, get to the Emperor's body, he gets up, and he was in a mood.
Oh, the Emperor definitely put on his boots of mighty ass-kicking. Because he just got hit by a black hole. And again, more props to the Emperor for being the baddest dude around. Bad dad, awful plans, unbelievably powerful, hardcore guy.
Yeah.
He stands up and goes, nah, ain't going out like that.
The note I wrote was, Proxima still exists as a planet, but all of the people who were on it at this time and their descendants do not. So I will actually, the Emperor went hardcore on this too, because not only does he just eliminate everyone in front of him and all the rebels, he then leaves the planet, turns to the 3rd Legion and says, hey, that planet just killed a bunch of your friends and brothers. Why don't you go kill every single person there? And they went, all right. Oh, and that's what happened.
And they didn't virus bomb it. They went door to door selling Girl Scout cookies.
Yeah, because the planet still retained strategic, and I believe it was an agriculture world, but it was a very healthy world. So they couldn't risk virus bombing it, but they also couldn't risk anyone on the planet still being alive. So they just murdered them all and brought in new settlers.
This is also when they got awarded the right to wear the Aquila.
Yeah, and this is cool. So the Emperor's children have, if you look at like old pictures of them, wear the Emperor's Aquila on their chest, just like anyone who plays modern 40K that's there. That they were the only ones who had this. No other legion wore the symbol of the Emperor on their armor. Actually, well, sorry, maybe the Custodes aren't a legion. So it was them and the Custodes. This actually did create a lot of, I wouldn't call it animosity, but jealousy from the other legions, because everyone else was like, it wasn't like all the other legions were like, well, I don't care about the Emperor. Well, all right, maybe Alpha Legion and the Night Lords, but most of the other ones, I don't think Alpha Legion gave any crap, if I'm being perfectly honest.
Alpharius has been loyal to the still.
Well, no, I'm not saying the lack of loyalty. What I'm saying is I don't think Alpharius cared if he was wearing the Aquila of the Emperor or not.
He was always in disguise anyways.
That's my point. Whereas the Blood Angels would have like, I want to wear that. That thing's cool. You know, the Ultramarines, they would have been super into it.
And for everybody that played with Modern, if you haven't looked at this, everybody has it now. It's just period. But
yeah, because the latest time.
Yeah. At the time, this was a huge deal.
Yeah.
And a huge source of pride, which we will probably say that word quite a bit, because it is wildly, by far, not even close, their biggest.
Pride is their jam. Now, an interesting thing happens too, and this one I like a lot, because we're about to tell you a story that just got, not retconned, but I got new information recently. During the endless conflicts on Mars, I'm going back now into like the dark age of technology, cloning became really critical. All humans on Mars are vat grown and heavily genetically modified, because the radiation toxin levels there are insane. And the mechanics like to tinker.
I was just about to say, and the bonus, why would we not screw around with it?
This just makes sense to us. So when the Emperor got to Mars, one of the main areas he took, aside from all the weaponry, was also what they were calling gene cults. These are the groups who, they use the term cult, by the way, a lot in 40K. Cult doesn't mean like small group of people doing weird things. It's more like job. So these were the guys whose job it was to work in on the genes. So he took these gene cults under the Imperium, and this was going to be massive for him for growing the Space Marines, because it's not just that they were more advanced. They just had more technology, more capabilities than were on Terra.
One of the things that was a big deal though, I think, was they had hands-on. They had people that had been doing this. You know, it wasn't even just they were better technologically. They had people that had been doing this for a while.
Well, yeah, the difference is the Emperor obviously had the Thunder Wars. He'd done this stuff back on Terra, but he was taking, you know, normal people, people who were born naturally, and converting them over. Whereas every single living being on Mars was genetically created. You know, it was vat grown, all this stuff. Again. So they were just better at it. They were just better at it. Yeah.
Yeah. They had hands on. You just go, hey, I was going to do this, but I've got Ted over here. who's got 100 years of this particular machine. Yeah, I'm going to let Ted do it. Yeah.
So over time, the emperor moved each of his genetic experiments to Terra, and he did them one legion at a time, you know, to kind of get them going. And what happened was at one point, the transit ship carrying all of the third legion genetic material got destroyed or disappeared. So that actually changes in the lore. Nothing was written forever about what happened. They just said that there were rumors. There were some stories that some rebels turned an orbital laser on the ship. We're going to get there. Yeah. Others were like a warp event just caused a ship to crash. But yeah, anyone who's a Necron fan knows what really happened. Trazen knew about the gene seed, thought it was cool, and he just went and took it, all of it.
Yeah, I was going to say,
entirety of the
Legion. He took the ship, basically.
Somewhere in Trajan's giant labyrinth, there is all of the gene seed for the third Legion.
What is he doing with it? Nothing. It is
nothing, because it's
exhibit 1,862.
Yeah. It's the guy who has an entire gene. Well, he had an entire gene stealer cult, all of it. Just hang with patriarchs and everything else, just hanging out in a pocket dimension in case it came up. Turns out C-Tans don't like them. Anyway, really good book, guys, by the way. Really, really good book, The Infinite and the Divine. Oh, yeah. So this loss, though, is catastrophic for the Legion because they lost really all but just a small sample that was left back on Terra. And what was thrown back there was minuscule in comparison. It will take them centuries to compound that formula and grow enough to be equal to what was lost. What makes this a lot worse is that we've covered before with gene seed. Yes, you can preserve gene seed in battle. You know, the apothecaries are equipped to actually extract the gene seed from a deceased space marine. But this requires two big things. One, there has to be a body left, and this is an era with Volkite, Plasma, Melta, Vortex. So there's not always something left you can pull gene seed out of. And second, they had to win the battle. And the truth is, the Space Marines didn't win every battle. They did retreat a lot. They would go into an engagement, they would lose soldiers, and they would retreat back. That means that Space Marine's gone. So in every single conflict, the Third Legion, it starts reducing their numbers every time. So they're effectively a dying legion at this stage, unless they can find a new source to pull their gene seed from. And, you know, I'm not a big, you know, I'm not Freddy Foreshadow over here. Let's do Fulgrim.
You should have went until.
Yeah. Well, but yeah, let's just jump into it because it's fun.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Fulgrim. Like every other Primarch, Fulgrim has an origin story, and it kind of sucks. Chemos, it's Chemos. I'm going to pronounce it Chemos and Chemos randomly as we talk about it, so sorry about that. Was this colossally crappy place in the galaxy. It was a mining planet that was settled during the Age of Technology that fell to disrepair during the Age of Strife. It's surrounded by a nebula dust cloud and had this very minimal binary star. And for those of you who listen to our Age of Technology, Age of Strife, you know, my immediate thought when I hear that is cybernetic rebellion. I don't believe the Imperium settled a planet in the Age of Technology that was a colossal piece of garbage with a crappy sun and surrounded by a dust cloud. I firmly believe it was a wonderful world where the star probably got hit by the Men of Iron, and the Nebula Dust Cloud used to be a moon or another planet that got blown up. And that's why it's so shitty.
I'll say, as usual, it was not great.
Yeah. So Chemos's problem is they actually can't produce enough materials or food to feed its populations. They had these vaporizers and synthesizers, GW's words, not mine, all over the planet, but only a few of them were working. And so they had to work all day and all night. And even then they couldn't produce enough. And so it's written that to keep the factories functioning, the population of Chemos worked all day. They would do nothing but work and sleep. So yeah. There was no art. There is no leisure. There's no joy in their lives. They wake up, they go to the factory, they work, and then they go to sleep because there are no extra resources. And even with all this, the population was just destined for extinction. Every day, the factories were aging and decaying. And so no matter how much rationing they did and what changes they made, eventually every factory would cease to function. The population would starve and die. So one day, scouts who are out looking for parts to repair a factory stumble across a pod that's crashed, and inside is little baby Fulgrim. And just like with Sanguinius, the thought was, let's murder that baby.
It is so crazy on that.
Yeah. And honestly, whereas Sanguinius was, it's a mutant, look at those wings, let's kill it. This was, we can't afford to feed this baby, someone murder that baby. But he was a very attractive baby, not in a creepy sense, but in a sense of like he looked, there was a perfection to him that no one had ever seen. And so they decide not to murder the baby, long story short. And he's.
How pretty of a baby do you have to be so that someone goes, we're going to kill that baby. There's no resources. That's a good looking baby. Like, is he the Gerber baby just given double guns?
Did he give him Magnum? I think he's a Primarch. I think he was Jack, and they were like, let's not. I also still think same thing with Sanguinius. I think someone did try to kill dead Sanguinius baby, and there's like 11 dead bodies just ringing the baby, and everyone's like, let's not try to do that again.
I don't know how these people died, but I don't want to be the next.
Yeah, but the common denominator is that baby in the middle, and I just want to go ahead and let's be nice to the baby. It's kind of, but anyway, so for whatever reason, they decide he's handed over to one of the people that found him, and the person names him Fulgrim, who's after like a former deity of the people of Chemos from the Age of Strife. And Fulgrim does the exact same montage every other Primarch does. He makes everything better for the people of Chemos pretty quickly. But he does it, they'll do it in a special
way. Not every Primarch, my friend. Not every Primarch.
Well, every Primarch improves the lives of the people. Well, no, I mean, everyone, even Conrad. Well, Conrad, to his group of people, made life better.
Sure, I guess.
Oh, for the people of the planet, it's a nightmare zone. I mean, yeah. It's
fine. Yeah, I was like, Fulgrim actually makes things pretty boss mode, actually.
Yeah, I mean, Fulgrim's up there with Bobby G just is obviously the perfect and the best. That's all that ever happened.
One of us likes one of the legions just a little bit more.
Just slightly more. I might be kind of a fan. I'm not sure how we're going to do an Ultramarine cast if it's just going to be me going, seriously, why don't all of you love them so much? But let's go into this. So what Fulgrim does, though, critically, is he drastically improves the output of all the factories. Primarchs, are geniuses. That at their core, they are geniuses. And so diagnosing and kind of improving machinery is easy for them. I mean, these are tactical geniuses. This is machinery. They can kind of see how all the pieces go together. And within a couple decades, Fulgrim turns his planet around. And in like a series of events, the last one's kind of the key one. The first thing he does is he fixes all the existing machinery to like optimum output. So the planet goes from a deficiency in production to a surplus. He then helps the people kind of spread out from the few factories they have left and reclaim even more of them, turning all the factories across the planet into these things, which then turns the entire planet into a manufacturing hub, which then produces enough resource to grow interstellar trade. And the planet then goes from this like dying hellscape to being a prosperous world, which interestingly is the next step from here. Really sets Fulgrim up for a lot of his fall, which is now that they've have a surplus and they've got all this stuff, they can start doing things like art, music, theater. Leisure enters their lives. And Fulgrim loves this.
All in. Fulgrim goes and just becomes obsessed with beauty in all forms. But also he instantly becomes pinkies out snob about it because he's obsessed instantaneously with only the best, the most beautiful, the perfect. You had to be perfection in what he was. And he's kind of short tempered about it. They make a little bit of it, but he's almost instantly a little bit. If you're not bringing me the best, why are you here?
Exactly.
With all of this. Yeah.
And what this happened, this starts fueling his entire life. And it gets a lot worse when the emperor shows up. So when the emperor comes to Chemos, it's actually very anticlimactic. Whereas, other people, the emperor had to challenge them or there was some fight or some this or some that. The emperor shows up, Fulgrim looks at him and immediately takes a knee and bows in fealty and declares his undying love. Though. Yeah.
He saw in the emperor what he thought was
perfection.
Perfection. Yeah. He immediately went, yep, that's what I want to do.
That's where I want to go. So the emperor grabs Fulgrim and they head back to Terra to unify him with his legion. And along the way, he starts teaching Fulgrim. The emperor, by the way, the emperor has one dad moment with each of the Primarchs. And it's right after he grabs each of them. He has that, like, let's go play catch in the yard. And by playing catch in the yard, I mean, I'm going to teach you all about my worldview. Actually, you really actually said it's not catch in the yard. It's pure indoctrination of my worldview, and I hope you follow through on it. As soon as I said the words out loud.
He might have been playing catch while he was doing this.
Yeah, but there was a lot of
how you indoctrinate people. The catch might have been part of it.
So he explains, so Fulgrim learns about that the only thing basically standing between humanity and extinction is the Imperium. The galaxy is full of horrifying Xenos, all this stuff. Nope, never mentions Chaos one time. It's just Xenos and Imperiums who don't understand how great the Emperor is.
I can't tell you my hard sigh about that so much. Horus Heresy, prevented by a series of quick emails.
Yeah. So Fulgrim takes all this in and really believes it. He feels, because don't forget, this is his legion all cares about protecting the weak. Man, do they stop doing that later. But they care about protecting the weak. He views the entirety of humanity as the weak and himself as the strong. And he is going to save all of them.
And now, specifically, his legion is going to save all of them.
Well, let's talk about his legion, because he gets back to Terra and his legion is a small crowd. There's 200 of them. At this moment in time, there were 250,000 Ultramarines. He had 200. I mean, they could have met at a Chili's, split a few appetizers, I have actually been to house parties that had more people at it than this. The cops showed up, but I have been in house parties that had more people than Fulgrim's entire legion. Now, none of them were 9-foot-tall super soldiers, but, this, that, or the other. So Fulgrim is told that they need to use him to extract a fresh gene seed, and that from there they can start implanting new recruits. And thanks to the people of Chemos and the nobility of Terra, they've got a good number of these recruits, but it's going to take decades to get the Legion back to strength. At least that's what it should have taken.
I was saying, weirdly, it did not.
Yeah, this GW timetables are everything's a montage. That's how I
would describe it. It did give him time to do two cool things. One, he started going on random side quests to level up, apparently.
Yeah.
But they were super cool. Also, he is a badass at this point in time. And he can also do shenanigans, because one of the things that Fulgrim has, every Primarch has their superpower, basically. Mm-hmm. Even before he's Demon Primarch, foreshadowing, he's got basically regeneration, more so than anybody else does, because he just takes it.
It improves.
He finds that out in those side quests, though. When he starts going out and doing shit, he's...
I'm invincible. Fun thing to learn.
Kind of.
fun thing to learn. Not a perpetual, but I mean, actually, I'll be honest, he's basically perpetual light, because he keeps getting his ass kicked later on. We'll cover this more in the next couple episodes.
I think he's bad at perpetual, but he definitely has regeneration, though.
Yeah, it's died a lot.
For sure.
Well, I more joke that he constantly loses almost all the way and then gets the comeback. That's kind of that's why I say he's a perpetual light. He's a Highlander who doesn't get his head chopped off, just gets stabbed.
He's a recurring villain on a show.
Oh, you're right. Let's go there. So let's go with one of his side quests now. The first one is him hanging out with Ferris Manus. So while on Terra, because Fulgrim gets kind of bored, there's not much to do. He can't take his legion out on a campaign. He's got to be local so they can keep extracting gene seeds out of him. They don't explain how they do that, and I don't want to know. That could be a bad part of the writing. So he just starts taking on stuff. And the first thing, one obviously, is art and culture. Fulcrum starts just traveling around Terra, visiting every art museum and every gallery and every like fashion show and all.
Yeah, but
this
he's
stuff.
Also he's doing it like a rock star though, because he also has like magical beauty. You know, people are seeing him.
Magical 80s beauty. I mean, let's call this out. Like he is a he's a 9 foot tall, ultra jacked dude with like long platinum hair. That's what he is. I mean, that's what he was. He's chiseled and with perfect facial features. So what he does is he starts dressing the part too. So he's everyone sees him. He's always wearing like robes and cloaks, even while armored. He's like, if he has his armor, he still has like, he always has like a high cloak around his neck so that everyone can see him. And he gets his reputation of like this like high fashion, like space marine. And he also becomes quite the patron of the arts. He's going around judging sculptures and paintings and all of these things. He becomes, in a lot of ways, he's a rock star, but like more of a cultural rock star.
He's an icon.
He does. And this does continue, by the way, when they leave Terra to begin to take part in the Great Crusade, he brings all this art with him.
Yeah. Yeah. I was saying he brings artists, musicians. He puts they put on full theater plays in his flagship.
Yeah.
I mean, full. He's doing like Cirque du Soleil and he's got huge stuff going on.
But while on Terra, he makes his first like real friend. And so Fulgrim's desire is in perfection. He wants to go make a perfect weapon to match his perfect appearance. And so he goes to this great forge under Mount Narondyna, Narodyna. And while as he walks in, there's a dude in there banging away on a sword, and it's Ferris Manus. And by dude, I mean a Primarch. He's a Primarch of the Iron Hands, who's crafting weapons.
The most apt name.
It's the worst one. I hate the fact that, and we'll cover him later, but his hands are made of metal. And so he has iron hands, and then his legion are the Iron Hands. Like, come on.
Don't be a hater, John.
No one else got that treatment. That's more what I'm saying. No one else got done that dirty. They were the only ones who got dirty. I mean, I guess the Ultramarines are kind of bad because they wear blue armor, but it's not like they were all blue and then they named them Ultramarines. Like it's just lame. Anyway, Fulgrim tells Ferris that, hey, I need to use your forge because I'm gonna go make a weapon. I'm gonna make the greatest weapon ever. And Fulgrim just looks at him. You know, this is a guy who's dressed like, you know, like highfalutin fashion, like Will Smith's kid walking in, right? And then
all I keep seeing is Zoolander.
It's what? Oh, you're right. You're right. This is a better example. It is Zoolander. I have the black lung. And Ferris looks at him. Yeah, well, he looks at his hands and points at his hands and says, "Not with those, you're not." And Ferris gets upset. So Fulgrim challenges him to a forge off because Ferris has now informed Fulgrim that the forge was a little too forged for him. And Fulgrim informs Ferris that he was going to forge him off because he could forge off anybody. Ferris disagrees and tells him that, no, I could forge you off. And if you don't get that reference, I'm sorry, because that movie was awesome. And this entire scene is how I envisioned that scene from that movie. So the next part, though, is purely canon, and I would have skipped it if it wasn't canon. Fulgrim and Ferris, in their face-off for their forge-off, decide to take their shirts off. No reason given. They just strip down to the waist and begin working the forge together. It's the same as those of you who've seen Commando, which I hope is all of you. One of the weirdest scenes the whole movie is he lands his seaplane. He then strips down to a banana hammock, rows to shore in a banana hammock, and then puts on the camo clothes and paints his face to go fight, you know, to actually go save his daughter. There's no, like, I guess he didn't want to get sweaty. I cannot figure it out. I mean, that being said, if I was built like a Greek god, which I'm not, I can't say I wouldn't find every moment to be in a banana hammock.
They're also just working the forge in front of a shit ton of people.
Oh, yeah, that's also the funniest part, too.
Isn't like his forge off to the side.
Yeah.
This is a full works project. Right. It's gigantic.
I've heard they also mentioned that all the other people in the forge like avert their eyes in awe of these two incredible beings banging away with hammers making weapons. Anyway,
the best.
Yeah. There's some hardcore montage happened at this moment. So anyway, 3 months later, the two Primarchs finish their work, of course, at the exact same time. Fulgrim has built a giant warhammer, and Ferris built a sword. And they both hand each other the sword, and they cannot find any flaws in the other one's sword. And they both declare the other one the winner. And to commemorate the event, they both give each other the weapon they made as a gift. And they become best friends at this moment. And this is...
You missed a 10. Did we just become best friends?
They were always best friends. That's the difference. I mean, that one.
I'm just saying, the stepbrothers one.
I guess it is true. Yeah, you're right. Well, I was more saying like the stepbrothers one. They tried to murder each other first. This one that they didn't. They just
did a three month forge off.
Yeah, they're trying to forge each other off pretty hard. Yeah. So I really do like the Barbie movie. And if you guys don't, I'm sorry. It was funny. Anyway, more importantly though, their bond is stronger than anything, because every Primarch, you know, viewed each other as a brother, but there was a variance to it. Like, you know, Conrad and Angron, whereas everyone's brother, but they weren't the first invite you sent to the party.
When they say brother, it's always me, has the implication that there's a question mark at the end of that.
Yeah, we're having an event. Everyone's invited. I mean, you guys, but hey, if you guys can't make it, it's totally cool. That was that part, that little extra bit was added to their invites. But this is, you know, right, surely they're after these two build their friendship, the Emperor's children, you know, reach a large enough to be deployed, not deployed independently, because they weren't large enough yet for a solo engagement, but they could now take some losses. And so they were assigned to the Luna Wolves. And the goal here was not to like make them subservient to Luna Wolves, but actually to help them learn from what was at this point the best chapter. Because Fulgrim now gets to learn from Horus, and he really learns, because Fulgrim is a fast learner.
Well, it goes beyond that, though. Fulgrim is obsessed, and I mean obsessed. He's Eldar level obsessed.
Yeah.
With perfection in all things, be it beauty, whatever, in battle. Every time there's a flaw, he wants that erased, and we will never do that again.
And the key thing with Horus is he goes and he learns the best way to do battle for the Imperium, and Fulgrim takes it, learns it, and immediately begins to improve on it. He looks at and the cool thing, and this is the early part of the Emperor's children, is this area here. This is what made them so good. After every battle, no matter how successful they were, he would come back and he would find the flaws that occurred, both in troop placement, movements, weapon selection, even the action of the troops themselves. The soldiers of the Emperor's children would spend more time in dueling and practicing than anyone else. They were looking to be absolutely perfect, as opposed to like the Space Wolves. And this is why I want to draw this out. There's no question that the Space Wolves were an incredibly efficient legion. They would decimate decimate's a terrible word. They would destroy their opposition. But the Space Wolves, after a victory, would go home and high-five each other and celebrate. The Emperor's children would have the same event that the Space Wolves would have, go home and like yell at themselves.
They're studying game tape immediately. Yeah,
and yelling at themselves in the mirror about how you could be better. So really, it's fair to argue at this stage, the Emperor's children were the best legion in the entire, as far as a soldier-to-soldier combo, were the best legion in the entire military.
Yes, but they're really on the precipice for a fall, even before chaos comes into this, because you can't maintain this.
Yeah, this desire for perfection is going to be an issue. And so what ends up happening is the Emperor's children grow enough to start doing some solo engagements, and they start moving around the galaxy. This leads them to a big one, which is the Lair. So the Emperor's children take their place in the Great Crusade. And, you know, Fulgrim is teaching his legion over and over again. Nothing short of perfection is acceptable. No matter the achievement, you can always do better. So he's basically a worse dad than the Emperor. One challenge for them is that as the Great Crusade continues, every legion gets their like moment to shine. They all gain some sort of renown, and all the other legions hear about it. Each of these moments, though, motivate the Emperor's children more than anyone else to be better. every time the Blood Angels are successful, the Ultramarines, Iron Warriors, whoever, every time they succeed in a major engagement, the Emperor's children look at that engagement and think to themselves, I could have done it better, I could have done it faster, and I could have had with less loss of life and less loss of resource every single time. And so their goal is to always, so every chance they get to do an engagement, they then strive to outperform everyone else.
It was such a big deal because every time they heard about the accomplishments of another legion, it wasn't that they had envy towards it. It basically damaged their pride that someone else was doing something better than they were. Why weren't they doing better than that? Not only just that, but like, we should always be better. And when I don't, if anybody else does anything, it shows on how I'm worse. And
one should ever be better than me. And again, this wasn't like I have to give them the credit here. This was never done in a way to undermine the Legion. They never, ever tried to undermine anyone else, hold anyone else accountable. This is the healthiest form of competition that exists. Something where, you know, I was an athlete for a very long time. I didn't care about losing. I cared about not improving. That was always my issue. Sometimes someone gets you, that's okay, but you need to improve. I always wanted to make sure when I lost, it was my fault. Side note. But anyway. Random ocean world. Out in the expanse of the galaxy, there's this reptilian species called the Lair. And the Lair live on a collection of floating structures using anti-grav technology. It's never written why the Imperium wanted this world, but I assume because there's nothing on it but water, I assume it's because they just wanted to soak up all the water to supply the fleets and colonies. Because the Lair are 100% Xeno. Like, there's no way they were not going to be exterminated by the Emperor. But it just says the world mattered. The problem, though, is that the Lair are two problems. One, highly technologically advanced. And two, Slaanesh cultists. Pretty serious Slaanesh cultists, too.
Oh, yeah.
Like, all the way. And the
one of the bigger things about this is, let's backtrack just a smidge. Slaanesh has been peeking over the wall, trying to figure out its in. Like, someone needs to introduce me to Fulgrim and his legion. I really want to be part of that.
Yeah. Problem solved. Because, remember, Fulgrim doesn't know what chaos is. I mean, the Emperor could have told anyone. I mean, not even all. To Brad's point about, like, you could send an email about, like, hey, this is chaos. He could have just told, like, three of the Primarchs. You don't have to tell Kurz or Angron. You could just tell, like, hey, tell Bobby G, you know, the Lion. Horus would have been helpful. Like, hey, this is this chaos thing. If you see it, burn it to the ground. The planet is called Laren, and the people there are called Lair, which is not easy for me to do. But anyway, upon entering the orbit above Laren, the Lair attack. And Fulgrim and his legion decide, screw that, we're killing every single one of these. The fun story on that, though, is that for whatever, the way they write this, the chronology doesn't work very well, but it's written that the Council of Terra said, oh no, just skip them, it's too much work to conquer it. But it also says that basically they attacked the fleet in orbit, and then right away Fulgrim attacked them back. So I don't understand how that's there, but just so someone doesn't call me out and say, well, actually it says this. It does, but just doesn't make chronologic sense. Effectively, and there's some other people in the Legion who are known for this. The Emperor's Children, by the way, did have a reputation for this. Of some would say, "Oh, that battle's not winnable," or the resource expended in that battle wouldn't make it worth it. You shouldn't do it. And the Emperor's Children go, "Hold my beer." They go and do it. Preserve, and by the way, preserve all the resource. They basically prove the naysayers wrong when they do this. And so that's what was happening on Lair. Fulgrim was being told, don't bother with it. They're too technologically advanced. We'll just nuke them from orbit later. Don't worry about it. And he goes, no, I don't need to do that. Watch this. Me and my legion are so good. We're going to take the bad odds and we're going to win by a landslide.
And I took that personally.
Exactly. So upon landing on the planet, the Emperor's children find that their senses are kind of getting overwhelmed. The entire planet has just this, like, really blaring, not music, just noise, colors. It's like
both.
Yeah, and it's offensive to the senses, the way the colors are together, because they're so extreme. It actually makes it hard to focus. This is actually the one time, Brad, you being colorblind would be helpful. Now, your migraines...
I was about to say, I don't think that my migraines would really do
your migraines and the noise they would drop you. You'd be in the ball crying on the ground, but the visuals wouldn't be that bad if they got some good noise canceling headphones. You just kind of wander through like, why is everyone so upset? Because the Lair are long fallen to chaos. They are basically where the Eldar were at the fall. So everything for them is an extreme for them. Every visual, every sense. Now, like, you know, Fulgrim, like any good Primarch, knows battle. He knows where to go. So he figures out pretty quickly that there's a main fortress and a capital building. And so he directs his forces there. And they're just rushing there, and they're killing every Lair on the way. But the goal is to cut the head off the serpent, ironically, because they're all...
This is a really, really cool story. We're going to try to do a little bit of justice.
The book here is called Fulgrim. The book is called Fulgrim. Get it. It's one of the... I think it was released after Flight of Eisenstein, but it kind of covers both. Very good fall story. It's one of the best ones. So
this battle is awesome.
Yeah. So Fulgrim rushes in, and at the center of the temple is a giant sword just floating in the air. And the Laren are hurtling themselves at the Emperor's children to kill them. Not again, the Lair, by the way, were not being influenced by Slaanesh to kind of like trick them into a deep battle. They were just, they're Slaaneshi cultists, and they just were enjoying the party. So the Space Marines slaughter them. Fulgrim walks over, and he sees this blade just sitting there. And it's perfect. I mean, true perfection. The handle is perfect. The curve of it is just the right curve. Even the placement and the color of the gem in the hilt is absolute perfect.
Which it also... became all these things for him specifically.
Yes. So Fulgrim picks it up as a war token, and it's to commemorate his great victory. Fun story. This is technically a blade. It's a power sword, but it's also a vessel that goes between the materium and the immaterium. And inside, because the blade itself was a chaos demon, or inside the blade, it's kind of hard to grasp it exactly.
Inside has a demon inside of it.
Yeah.
If you were playing a game,
a cursed sword.
When you picked up the sword, it would have been named unbelievably cursed sword. This is obviously a cursed weapon.
Yeah. You don't have to cast detect magic. We're good. So what happens is he begins carrying the sword around him with him everywhere. And a couple things occur, because like any cursed weapon, anyone who's done any sort of sci-fi or fantasy knows, the longer you're around a cursed item, the more effect it has. So Fulgrim starts off by just kind of hearing whispers in the back of his mind, which he actually assumes is his own conscious, like talking to him. And because the whispers they're all designed to kind of drive his thinking more towards Slaanesh. But don't forget, Fulgrim naturally kind of goes that way. So he doesn't really view this as someone trying to manipulate him one way. He views it as just a reinforcement in his own thinking. Because the demon, and like all demons, are trying to send him down a path of ruin. Because if it can do that, then it can take possession of him. And this happens right about the same time the Horus Heresy starts to begin in earnest. So,
yeah, this is close to Davin is coming up really quick here.
Yeah, so just shortly before Davin, Fulgrim and his legion are sent to a place called the Diasporax. The Diasporax were a civilization of human-Xeno alliances that dated back to the Age of Strife. The Iron Hands were sent to the sector to spread the Imperial Truth to them, which really consists, and by Imperial Truth, what they mean is all the humans who are part of the Diasporax need to go murder all the Xenos who are part of the Diasporax. And all those humans were like, well, we wouldn't have survived the long night if it wasn't for them. We don't know who you guys are. How about you, you know, get the hell out of here? This is our neighborhood.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And these two obviously go to battle. And the issue is, as why I'm glad we did a coverage of the Age of Technology, the Diasporax are someone who survived the Age of Strife because they preserved and had most of their Age of Technology equipment, which meant they were actually better equipped and better armed than the Space Marine Legions. So the Iron Hands immediately run into problems. They are, you know, they're not necessarily losing, but they're not winning. So they call in for reinforcements, and Fulgrim and his Legion come to assist his best friend. and these enemies and the Emperor. And so for Fulgrim, this is awesome. This is a twofer. He gets to wage war with his best friend and be a savior for humanity by destroying the enemies of humanity. But during the battle, we get the first glimpse of chaos kind of affecting Fulgrim, because the Diasporex, it's a space battle. The Diasporex attack. They attack the Fulgrim's ship, the Firebird, and start wrecking it to the point where the Firebird probably, like Fulgrim might die here. The ship is completely getting ruined. Ferris sees this and turns his ship and basically hits the afterburners and slams in the Diasporex ship, saving Fulgrim and his crew. Ferris just saved Fulgrim, but Fulgrim just takes this as a personal affront. He doesn't say it, it's not outward, by the way. In the book, none of this is outward, it's all internal. No,
but
it's all rage.
But his internal, remember, his internal monologue isn't his internal monologue. It's the possessed demon
talking to
sitting
him.
There,
yeah.
Talking to him and going, because originally he saved my brother, saved me. Wait. Did my brother just try to steal my glory?
Bingo.
Is he showing me
up?
Is he trying to show that I have flaws? Is he trying to show my flaws?
Yeah.
Why would he do this?
And that's the big shift, because old Fulgrim would have seen Ferris saving him as a failure of himself and a desire to improve himself. But now he sees intent in what Ferris did to try and stow a doubt throughout, not just throughout the entirety of the Imperium, of the superiority of Fulgrim. Right about this exact time, Horus and his legion are land on Devon, and to deal with Eugene Temba, Horus gets stabbed by a demon blade, and he ends up in the Serpent Lodge, giving himself over to the chaos. Fulgrim's not aware of this, but this is all happening right about the same time.
This is a big deal in this, though, because Fulgrim makes an almost quick flip, because he's been being corrupted this whole time. But right as of this point, he goes from, I want to make myself better to be better, to I want to show everybody and push them down. Yep.
Yeah. And Fulgrim's going to go
wild in me.
Well, yeah, let's talk with Fulgrim is going to go meet one of Brad's buddies, and Brad's buddy screws this up royally.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
So Fulgrim goes to a maiden world. They don't know it's a maiden world. The world Tarsus, which is a maiden world, a.k.a. former our home world. And while walking along there, he bumps into a small group of little elves, one of which is Eldred, the Farseer of the Ulthway, who is, just want to point this out again, supposed to be the greatest Farseer of all the Eldar. So he can scry all the way into the future.
See, all right. Nothing
could ever happen.
I'm defending Eldred on this one.
There's no defending. Eldred
saw his meeting. He knew that Horus had been corrupted.
Oh, yeah.
And he went to tell Fulgrim about it.
Let's keep going. Eldred's also one of the most powerful psychers in all of them. So he has a better connection to the warp than any other Eldar. What's Eldred do? Well, he starts explaining to Fulgrim how Horus, which, and, to Brad's point, is being corrupted as we speak, giving himself over to chaos. This long and passionate speech. And at no point in the speech does he notice the demon blade hanging from the from the waist of the Primarch he's talking to, or notice the Primarch talking to has demonic corruption inside of him. That all just gets missed.
I mean, potato, potato. I mean, sometimes you're going to miss something too.
Yeah, sometimes you miss like the most important piece. There was a blade with a demon prince inside it, like 10 feet from Eldred, and he just ignored that feature kept going on. I have a speech.
Yeah, I think it's a bigger thing that he foresaw his meeting with Fulgrim, but he didn't foresee the fact that Fulgrim did not take this news well.
No, Fulgrim attacks. And I'm not going to ruin what is an epic fight scene, but it does involve an avatar of Kane. So again, the book is Fulgrim. Just go ahead and read it.
I mean, Eldred did have a backup plan, which was that. So
yeah. And how'd that go? Not great. Anyway.
I mean, he's Eldred's still alive, bro.
That's true. He is still alive, but he's so bad at foresight. I mean, he's just so bad. It is like, I can see into the future kind of, sort of, but not with a lot of detail.
No. Real foggy.
Yeah, very foggy. Man needs some glasses.
Clouded by the dark side, the future is.
Yeah, man, just getting some readers. All right, he's an old man. It's okay. Like I have to wear readers now. He can wear readers. I'm pretty close to having to turn a light on when I read a menu at a dark restaurant. Yeah, 40, by the way, for all our young listeners, that happens in your 40s. It's BS, man. It's BS. Anyway.
40s. So, put that in the rearview mirror.
Oh, you but come on. I entered my 40s healthy. How did you do?
I limped in. I limped in. I was there. I'm still here.
Yeah. I mean, you're doing fine, but just.
I didn't hear no bell.
Exactly. I'm just saying, other two of us, my 40-year-old heart is better than your 40-year-old heart was. Not saying much.
My 40-year-old heart isn't even all my heart.
That's true, yeah. It's true. You did come in with extra pieces. That's right. I didn't. Mine's all just me. Yeah.
I am bonus. I'm Ad Mac.
Exactly. All right. So upon leaving Tartus, Fulgrim makes haste to head over to Horus because he doesn't want to believe what Eldred says, but he also doesn't not believe it. And when he arrived, it's way too late. Horus has already made his dark pact and he's full down the path. But one thing about Horus, and this is important, he's a master negotiator and orator.
Whoa. Yeah, that's his superpower. Remember, mm-hmm. his charisma on this. But also, I actually think that right now is peak Horus power with being Horus still, because he's way more powerful by the time he gets to Terra, but that's not even Horus anymore. Yeah,
but he's more powerful. He's chaos power. He's still at this stage very much so Horus, because the truth is, and to defend him and defend the story, that's because right now all the chaos gods are pouring all their energy into him, as opposed to later on when they're all playing the great game. So they're putting energy into it, but they also want to win. And so there's a lot of other stuff going on. This stage, everything is about, we have to get this guy to fight the Emperor. So let's just make sure he's there. So he's operating at 12.
They convince him, they power him up.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's so jacked right now.
Yeah.
And he was already, anytime Horus came to a negotiation, he won.
Yeah.
That negotiation was over. And now he's super powered with that ability. I think Fulgrim had no chance.
They do go over like what he says. The short story of what he says is he just appeals massively to Fulgrim's natural tendencies. He points out that, you know, the Emperor didn't just betray the Primarchs. He betrayed all of humanity. So that's a big check for Fulgrim right there. Humanity could be this perfect force in the galaxy, a shining light against the darkness. But the Emperor wants to let puny small men make decisions. And if the Emperor is left to do this stuff, there will be bickering and fighting. This is the kind of stuff Fulgrim just can't handle. And the last
imperfection everywhere.
Exactly. He's saying, if we could do this, we could overthrow the Emperor and we could create a perfect humanity. And Fulgrim just goes, all right. It doesn't help. It doesn't hurt. By the way, there's a demon blade just cheering him on in the background the whole time. Like, yeah, you know, just that hype kid.
This is the best idea ever.
So at the end of this, Fulgrim is convinced and Horus says, hey, I need you. We need more allies though. Can you go talk to Ferris Manus and sway him over? Fulgrim does this. And I want to make a quick side note here, because Fulgrim is not the only one who does this. We've seen this with Mortarion. We've seen this with Magnus. We've seen this happen over and over again. With the exception of like Alpharius and maybe Pederabo, all of the Primarchs that were turned to chaos were already pretty heavily affected or influenced by chaos gods in one way or another. They didn't know it, but it was there. And so I bring this up because all the traitor Primarchs, they all flip pretty quickly. And this is because they were being manipulated even beforehand. The problem is that when you then believe in something so easily, we're like, oh, well, this just makes objective sense. And then you go and tell someone who's not being influenced by chaos gods, it doesn't go great.
Right. Also, you're not Horus.
Yeah, you're also not Horus. But even if it was Horus, I don't think Horus flips Ferris. I mean, we'll skip Sanguinius.
Gets him to listen.
That's true. Yeah, we'll skip Sanguinius and Gilliman, Lion. They were never flipping. But even like Ferris, Ferris, Korvax, your buddy. None of them, I think, flip either.
I'm just trying to think to myself, you heard this wildly supernatural charismatic guy explain, you know, this pyramid scheme, and then you try to tell the next person, you're like, you should let him tell you. Yeah, it was way cooler.
I got an example I use is actually Radiohead, and I use it because if you know anyone if you like Radiohead, or you know anyone who really likes Radiohead, people who like Radiohead, it is like, it speaks to their soul. They talk about listening to Radiohead like it's a mind-changing experience. But if you don't like Radiohead and you hear it, you go, yeah, man, that's music. Okay. And that's what it is. And that's what this was for these guys. So Fulgrim gets this speech from Horus. He's just like, it's checking every box for him. He's feeling it all the way in his soul. Like, yeah, let's go. I can't wait to tell everyone else about it. And everyone else is like, I mean, it's a good song, man, but like, I don't want to listen to it again. So anyway, Fulgrim and Ferris meet, and they meet in the actually inner sanctum of Ferris's flagship. And Fulgrim does this whole speech about all these great points, all this stuff, how, you know, how the Emperor's betrayed them, blah, 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 blah. At the end of it says, right? And Ferris basically punches him in the face.
It's a big deal, though, to get where Fulgrim is at this point in time. Yeah. Fulgrim is, when he comes in here, is 100% convinced that he's,
oh yeah,
I've got this.
My best friend is going to totally do this, the thing I did. And Ferris's response is to tell him, F you. How dare you? I now, by the way, not only do I disagree with you, I'm going to kill you now because you are an enemy to the Emperor. You are a traitor. And these two have the fisticuffs.
Oh, it becomes so much better because in true 80s movie mojo, each pulls out the the weapon that the other had foraged for them.
And they begin fighting with it. And it ends, and the fight, but this is, again, this is where Fulgrim's fall starts to move into the tragedy piece. So Fulgrim goes to swing down on Ferris, and Ferris grabs the sword, because Ferris does have iron hands. Yep. And he crushes the sword in his hand. When he crushes it, because it's a power sword, it explodes. And the explosion knocks them both across the room, you know, 80s movie, maybe a little anime if you want, if more for that. And as Brad mentioned earlier, Fulgrim's got some kind of super healing capabilities. So while they're both unconscious, Fulgrim just gets up and walks over. Yep. And Ferris is lying unconscious on the ground. Fulgrim picks up the hammer that he built for Ferris and goes to kill him with it, and he can't. While he's got it above his head, though, the demon blade is screaming in his ear, kill him, kill him, kill him. And Fulgrim can't. He just drops the hammer and walks out. Now, when he walks out, he does have his personal guard murder all of the people on the bridge. Yeah, everyone on the bridge. So he doesn't kill Ferris. Everyone else dies. And then he gets on his ship, leaves, and then has his ships turn on and just destroy the fleet. Not kill again, not killing Ferris, but wrecking his fleet and heading back to go hang out with Horus. So as you can imagine, this is not, Fulgrim now is going pretty quickly down the path of chaos. But we've been talking about him for a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about not just him, but the people around him. Because when a Primarch, everyone falls differently, but this whole legion falls. And so we talked before.
In an awesome play.
Well, there's a lot of steps to this. And man, this is actually two books. This is the book Fulgrim, and I think it's the second book of the Horus Heresy, whose name is escaping me right now. But it's the second book is where a lot of this stuff takes off, I think. 80%. It's the first, second book.
I mean, we've got a little bit more to go, but the play is pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'm just going to tell everyone, read the first five books of the Horus Heresy. They're just, if you read the first, they all
hit them out of the park.
They're all out of the park, and the storyline is exciting. Read the first five. Just don't ask me, like, people always ask, which book is this? Just read the first five, because a lot of this is just memory bouncing between those books. So anyway, so when, back to the Space Legion, the Space Marine Legion itself, gene seed is more than just genetic coding to a Primarch. They actually share a piece of the soul of their Primarch, because as we learned from Korax in the warp, Primarchs aren't humans who are made super. They are actually warp entity brought together and then crafted to appear human by the Emperor. That's what they really are. So when you do a gene seed from the Primarch, it actually is effectively warp that you're putting into the Space Marines, which creates an attachment. So what this does is that when a Primarch gives themselves over to chaos, that part of them then seeps in to all of their legion. Doesn't always convert them over instantly. It did in the case of the Thousand Sons, but it's more, it gives the chaos.
They were all sorcerers already.
That's true, yeah.
I think that's why.
That would make sense, but it gives chaos away. So now the influence of Slaanesh is able to spread throughout the Legion. And they see it throughout the whole Legion. Uncontrollable jealousy towards each other. Like one by one, the most loyal and exemplary members of the Legion start turning to Slaanesh worship. But it is done in these ways where it's always an extreme. And we're going to get to someone in a minute, but the first thing I want to talk about is that with this transition, it's not just with the Space Marines who are switching over. It's anyone even in the presence. And this,
and remember, all of the Space Marine Legions have all of the helpers. They have everything going on. Horus has an entire ship full of artisans. He's got painters,
Fulgrim,
musicians.
Fulgrim has.
Yeah. Fulgrim has them bouncing around.
Yeah.
But these people become entranced by Slaanesh. Yeah. And entranced, I think, is the actual right word for that.
It is.
Because they can't think of anything else. Slaanesh is awesome at this, because what happens is the road to corruption, they start focusing on that thing that they can't achieve. And Slaanesh kind of dangles the carrot of, you should only be thinking about this, and I can make it so that you can do it.
Let's talk about it, because this is really well drawn out in the book. That's why we're going to spend time on it. Serene DeAngelis. So Serene was a painter that Fulgrim brought with him on the Great Crusade. And Serene was told to make a giant painting for Fulgrim, for his main room, whatever you want to call
it. Call it what it is, though. She was told to make a masterpiece for Fulgrim. That's a line from the book on that. Yeah. It isn't they went, we need you to do a painting for Fulgrim. No. You need to make a masterpiece
for Fulgrim. And she had writer's block for like 20 years. But she was present when they invaded Laren and actually walked through the great temple there. This is not a space marine. She is instantly corrupted by Slaanesh. Like, boom, done. I'm now on it. And she gets, and being there, she sees the very heavy air quotes beauty here, goes back to her studio and gets to work. But she takes all her paints, all her oils, and throws them in the garbage. And she begins cutting herself, cutting pieces of herself off, and starts using them. As after a while of manipulating herself and cutting herself, she begins murdering other people and using them in this masterpiece. To the point where when this whole thing is done, it is horrifying. It is a giant painting of blood, decaying body parts. Looking at it would actually cause corruption. But if you're corrupted by Slaanesh, it's one of the most beautiful things ever. It's unveiled, to Brad's comment earlier, but at this massive banquet on the eve of the Istvan battle. So there we go. At the same time, there's another person named Kinska. And like Serene, Kinska was also present at Lair, but Kinska was a composer. Kinska heard the noise that was playing throughout Lair and copies it and makes that in. Everyone walks into the room and this symphony.
It's a huge.
Yeah, hall, I mean, thousands upon thousands of space marines, you know, just regular army, whatever it is, everyone is in the room and this music is blaring. And by the way, most people think the music sucks. It's pretty rough. This stuff is, unless you're all the way corrupted. Rating. Yeah. But as it's going, this music, though, actually is a beat that creates a connection into the Immaterium. And as it begins, gets to its crescendo.
Well, they're leading up to the crescendo because the whole time there's a performance going on with this.
People are dancing. And then at the crescendo, the painting is unveiled. The music becomes insane. And boom, there's now a flip. And now the Immaterium has access to the Materium. Noise. This is actually where the first noise marines come in, because there's a special instrument that actually shot noise. But demonettes appear. They possess people, come bursting out.
They possess all the people on stage, just explode, and demonettes start coming out.
And there's a massive slaughter. And this is the next day. I can't remember Istvan 3 or Istvan 5 was the next day. But it was one of the Istvans.
I love, you got to read this book, because it's so. Oh. The whole time Fulgrim is just sitting there with like a glass of wine, This is the greatest symphony when people are just getting killed around him. This is perfect.
The other one I want to spend time on, because he's going to come up a lot more in our next cast, is Lucius the Eternal. So Lucius is he's a good example of the Space Marine fall. Lucius is a Space Marine who was human, born on Kamos, he went through the gene seed process, becomes a Space Marine. And he is arguably the greatest duelist in all of the Space Marine Legions. non-Primarch.
I was just about to say, he also gets wrecked a bunch.
No, not in this era. Later he does. Not in this era.
True.
In this era. And so, like, it gets stated that for multiple solar months of engagements, he never took one step backwards. However, he was kind of also a prick. Because he's not only the greatest... I mean, a little bit. Because he's not just the greatest duelist. He wanted to make sure everyone knew he was the greatest duelist. So in every battle, he would, like, leap to the front and just to get the most kills. Or even just playing with his opponents. Like, just to get the most, like, wounds on them before killing them. He didn't really care what the battle plan was. So, like, this is where he wasn't a very good emperor's children, because while being a perfect warrior himself, he undermined them being a perfect legion in their combat.
And so he was personally responsible for so many casualties.
Yes, he got in a lot of trouble because he was a captain, but he got in a lot of trouble because he wouldn't follow the plan. So he was like this liked and disliked guy. One thing that was interesting about him, though, was that Lucius, his turn to chaos predates his Primarch. He starts 100%. Going, yeah, he goes well before, because his obsession with perfection made him an easy target for Slaanesh, and she gets in there pretty well. And we don't really know when he does this, but there's a big flip in him. So Lucius was beautiful, like all Emperor's children, long, flowing, beautiful hair, great facial features, tall, strong man. At some point, other soldiers begin to comment about, and it's meant to be a compliment, that, wow, he has like more kills than anyone else, but he's still flawless. He has no scars. Most soldiers have scars because you do get shot. You know, you do get stabbed. Stuff blows up. Not Lucius. Lucius was clean. So it was amazing to see this person who had almost dainty features, and you're saying, oh, yeah, that's the most dangerous murderer in our entire legion. And everyone's like, really? That guy? Lucius, though, rather than taking that as a compliment, takes it as an insult. And he decides that he should have scars. And he starts off by just literally cutting himself with his blades. Deep, too. Not like a little happy superficial scars. He's shoving it like an inch or two into his skin. Like down to the bone, in the case of his skull. He, at some point during this period, meets Serena before she, you know, goes all the way nuts. But she has begun mutilating herself. So he asks her, well, why are you doing this? Why are you mutilating yourself? And she says, well, every one of my mutilations is for one of the victims that I've killed to make this great painting. Again, Lucius is already corrupted. So he's not like, oh, that makes sense. Lucius goes, well, I've killed a lot more people than she has. The people I've killed were a lot more impressive than the ones she's had. So I should have some pretty cool marks. Lucius goes.
She also carves effectively chaos icons all over him.
Yeah. Lucius goes into, he goes from this beautiful figure to all his hair is gone. He is scarred head to toe completely. The part of this that's funny, though, to me, is what happens next with Lucius. So we're going to close this episode out with a couple quick bangs. Istvan 3 and Istvan 5. Very quick recap. Istvan 3 was because Horus is ready to turn against the Emperor. He's got an issue. He has to go against the Emperor. He has a bunch of legions that are not with him. And even within his own legion, he has a bunch of people who aren't really with him. So he has to go purge his legion. And then he has to take out as much of a chunk of the loyalist legions as he can. He sends, you know, Gilliman, Leman, the Line, and Sanguinius to the other side of the galaxy because they're the most dangerous for him. But the other bits he has to do manually. So the first thing he does is Istvan 3, where he's going to purge half of all of his legions. So there's a planet.
This is still my favorite who he sends down, though.
It's just,
Well, no, because it's, you know, he sends the Death Guard down. He sends Emperor's Children down. And then you're looking at it and you're like, and he sends the six guys from the World Eaters that didn't
get over to chaos. All the World Eaters, they were like, it's Eric, Sean, Tim, and Bob. Like those you've got 100,000 of us are on you. Well, you know, it's 99,997 of us are totally online. But those dudes, we don't trust those dudes. So you could send them down.
A little bit of a problem. You
know, that'd be kind of cool for us. Just let's kick them down here.
That's just one of my favorites. Just because of that. It's like, what? Like half the Legion is being sent down and these
dudes. And these dudes in the World Eaters. They were just like, look, man, the butcher nails just didn't take. That's all I could take. I'll tell you. But interestingly, one of the people sent down Nistvan is Lucius, because despite being covered in scars that he inflicted on himself, ones that have like their chaos symbols, they're like,
he's covered in chaos symbols.
But his best
we can't trust him.
Yeah, but his best friend is Saul Tarvitz, who is the inverse of traitor.
No one's more loyal than Saul.
So
till the very end.
So Lucius is stuck down there on Istvan when the whole battle breaks out, and the battle comes in like it would come like we've all discussed before. They're gonna bomb them from orbit, but then Angron screws that up, so then they have to manual combat. But the important part about Lucius at this moment is Lucius gets a note affected from chaos saying, if you will kill your brothers, you can rejoin your legion. So he goes, okay, and slaughters 30 Astartes in an instant, and then walks over to the chaos line and says, I'm with you guys now. And they all go, cool. And then he now has joined chaos. But
you're like, also joined a while ago.
Yeah, like, I don't know why I had to do that, but totally cool with it, but don't know why I had to do it. But let's finish up with the big one, which is Istvan V. So in Istvan V, Salamanders, the Raven Guard, and the Iron Hands arrive, and they're there to kill Horus and Fulgrim. I think there was just those two. I don't think they knew. It was just those two. Oh, and Angron, I think. So yeah, and Angron. And they're supported, unfortunately, by the Night Lords, the Iron Warriors, Alpha Legion, and the Word Bearers. Supported in heavy air quotes. In the battle, Ferris, leading his Iron Warriors, comes upon Fulgrim and tells him, I'm here to kill you this time. And they begin fighting. But as they're fighting, Fulgrim starts smiling. And Ferris, by the way, is beating the crap out of Fulgrim. So Ferris can't figure out, well, why are you smiling? And at that moment, the trap is sprung. And Ferris looks around and watches as his legion is just demolished by traitors. They're being shot at from behind, from everywhere. Everything, this is now, the battle is lost effectively. And he's looking around watching just like horror as his legion is destroyed. The other legions are destroyed and seeing pure traitors. And he turns to Fulgrim and that's it. And he attacks and starts beating the ever living crap out of Fulgrim. I mean, beating him into the ground. Just as he's about to give a fatal blow, Fulgrim just gets up and draws the demon blade, because he'd been fighting with a different sword, and he parries with the demon blade. He takes the demon blade and he slashes Ferris across the chest, and Ferris drops. He's not dead, but he's harmed. And Fulgrim is at this moment, picks up the demon blade to kill Ferris, and has that moment of pure clarity where he looks around and sees the battle and sees what's happening. And he's looking around and realizes he's about to kill his best friend. All of the legions,
brothers are killing brothers
everywhere. This is the inverse. He was one of the most loyal members, and he's looking around at this. And as he's surveying it, his hand begins to move, because the demon blade is just like, I'm having enough of this. And the sword cuts Ferris's head off, and Fulgrim just stands there above his decapitated best friend and is just in sorrow. And
he's broken.
Yeah, Fulgrim falls to his knees, basically in tears, as to what's going on. And the demon inside the demon blade tells him, don't worry about it. I can release you from all of this. Just say the word. So Fulgrim says the word. And upon that word, Fulgrim is now, his soul is sucked out and goes into the demon blade. The demon takes over his body. And Fulgrim is now imprisoned within this sword for now. And the demon has taken control of his body.
Nobody gets possessed more than Fulgrim.
I know. And that's where we're going to break. Because next week, we're going hard into the Emperor's Children, the Horus Heresy, which they do a lot of, and then some of the post. I think this is going to end up being a three-part cast, guys, because this was, you know, this one went, we're not even, we got to Istvan V in over, it took us almost an hour and 15, hour and 20.
I would say we're not even a Demon Prime.
We have a lot to get to with him. So it might be a three-part caster. And we'll have to cover Fabius Bile. So, probably a three-parter, but it's actually pretty good, and especially the new codex coming out. I'm excited about this, so letting you know. Next week, we're going to be doing a bunch of Fulgrim getting super weird, then his legion getting super weird, including more stuff with Lucius, some stuff with Fabius Bile, where these guys really embrace Slaanesh hard. But until then, This is John Barsotti and Brad Chester.
This guy.
See you next week.